So, Manjushri practice is especially to help us develop our wisdom. So all the Buddhas have the same realization. It's not that Manjushri has more wisdom than all the other Buddhas and less compassion, but they all have the same realizations. It's just that Manjushri's specialty is wisdom, and he's the manifestation of the wisdom of all the Buddhas. There's different forms of Manjushri. You know, this is the red-yellow form. There's also a white Manjushri, a black Manjushri. The terrifying Manjushri is Yamataka or Dorje Jigje. So there's a lot of different forms of Manjushri. And they're all to develop wisdom. Now, there's a big difference between knowledge and wisdom. Okay? And we often get these things quite confused in our life, because we think if we have knowledge and we know a lot, that therefore we're wise. No. Okay? We think if we remember a lot, that therefore we're wise. Okay? I mean, the computer just remembers things far better than we do. Okay? Do they have wisdom? No. Okay? So there's a big difference in our life between knowing things and having information, and then having the wisdom of how to use that information in a kind way and in an appropriate way. Okay? So although Manjushri practice can be used to help us with our memory, it can be used to help us, you know, so we can gain information and remember information. It can also be used to help people who have difficulties with stuttering and, you know, all sorts of things like this. But the real purpose is to develop wisdom. And it's not just the wisdom of, you know, subatomic particles and the wisdom of how electricity works, because that's basically knowledge, isn't it? Okay? So we're looking for the wisdom here that understands the nature of reality. So even regarding the nature of reality, there's the difference between having the knowledge about it and the wisdom about it. Because we can recite all the scriptures and, you know, recite many, many lectures, you know, giving the whole outline of, you know, emptiness and the 18 types of emptiness and the four opponent powers that you use and the different this about emptiness and blah, 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 that, but without having any kind of realization in our mind about it. So we can have knowledge about emptiness, but without the wisdom realizing it. So, you know, first we need the knowledge. We need some kind of, you know, information so that we can know how to meditate and know how to develop wisdom. But the real thing that we're looking after here is the wisdom, because it's the wisdom that's going to change our mind. Sometimes we talk about four different kinds of wisdom. There's various ways to talk about wisdom, but one way is four kinds. We have the innate wisdom that we're born with, then the wisdom arising from hearing, wisdom arising from thinking or contemplating or reflecting, and then the wisdom arising from meditating. Okay? Now often, this first one, you know, the wisdom, the innate wisdom, that's the wisdom that's a carryover from previous lives. Okay? So whatever we trained our minds in previous lives, that kind of wisdom that we have that deep imprint with, that comes along into this life. And so you see some people, you know, from the time they're young, they get it better than other people get it. Okay? Now, we often think that that's the only defining fact, that that's the only kind of wisdom, that you either got it or you don't got it. Okay? And that's not it. Okay? Because that's only one of the four, and that's the only one actually that comes as a result of previous lives. The next three of hearing, thinking, and meditating are developed in this life. So it's really emphasizing that we can develop wisdom in this very lifetime. And that's why we're doing this practice. So the first wisdom, it's often literally translated as the wisdom of hearing, but it actually includes reading and studying. Okay, so it's the wisdom of learning. Yeah. So this might have some element of gaining knowledge in it, but when you're listening to teachings, when you're studying them, when you're reading them, there can also be a certain arisal of wisdom in your own mind. And you can see this as you practice the Dharma, because the more you practice, the more you become familiar with the different topics, the more you purify and the more you, you know, develop positive potential in your own mind stream. Then when you listen to teachings, you can have a totally different experience of what the words mean when you're listening, or a totally different experience of what the book means. Yeah. And I just had this so clearly, my own experience. I think I remember the first Kopan course I went to in 75 and the second one in 76. Okay. In the middle, I did the Vajrasattva retreat. Yeah. So I heard one course in 75, did the Vajrasattva retreat. When I came back in 76, I was going, is this what he taught last year? It's like totally new. It was going in a totally different way. Okay? And some of you may have experienced that too, you know? Like even a topic, you know, like precious human life. You listen to it the first time and you go, precious human life? 8 freedoms and 10 fortunes and what's all this stuff? I don't get it. And, you know? And then as you become familiar and you purify and you create merit, then you listen to the teachings on precious human life. A whole different experience in your heart and some kind of feeling comes. Even though, you know, the words you're listening to or the words you're reading are exactly the same thing. Any of you had that experience? Okay. So, you know, it's something coming from us. Yeah. Which is always what's so interesting about giving a Dharma talk is, you know, one person hears the Dharma talk and goes, and another person goes, wow. And they're both convinced that it came completely from outside of them. Yeah. I got this letter from, I give a seminar in Esalen. Yeah. And most of the people seem to enjoy the seminar. But one guy took he made the effort to write a feedback letter to them saying, you know, I've been coming to Esalen for 20 years and this is like the most terrible workshop I ever went to. And, you know, she doesn't know what she's talking about and she's preachy and she's infatuated with herself and she comes across like a Buddhist Dr. Laura. So I have a new title. But, you know, this is the difference between different people listening to the same teaching. Okay? Yeah? So, you know, the wisdom that's derived from hearing or listening, it's an interplay with our own mind. Okay? So you can see as you practice and purify and create merit, that your positive potential, that's going to change. Okay? Then, we not only listen or study the teachings, we have to then think about them, reflect on them, you know, contemplate them, try and understand them properly. Because sometimes we listen to them, we think we understood, we're totally off base. Yeah? We don't have the right idea at all. And that's why it's so valuable to meet together and discuss together. You know, and the sessions that you have when I'm traveling are so useful because when you discuss, you all of a sudden have to see how much you understand, you know, and you listen to other people's understanding and you compare it to your understanding and you see what you don't understand correctly or what they don't, and there's a lot of learning that goes on there. So that second step is to make sure that we have the correct understanding of the teachings. You know, it's not just sufficient to know the words and even be able to recite the words, because sometimes we can do that, but in our heart we misunderstand them. Okay? And this can go on for many years before we actually realize it. Yeah? And then, once we've thought or reflected or contemplated on the teachings, then we meditate on them. So the actual wisdom that arises from meditation is really a union of shamatha and vipassana. okay, calm abiding and special insight. So that's quite a deep level of wisdom that's coming in the meditation. But those three wisdoms are developed in this very life. Okay, and so I think that's important to recognize and not just feel, oh, well, you know, I didn't do very well in school, so how am I ever going to learn the Dharma? I mean, that's not true because, first of all, you know, what we come into with this life is one kind of wisdom, and the other three we gain in this life. And second of all, worldly, quote, quote, wisdom and Dharma wisdom are two different ballgames. Yeah, and I've met people who have a lot of worldly wisdom, you know, high careers, PhDs, da 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 da, but you take them to the Dharma talk and they don't get it. You know, there's no facility in them to look inside and look at their own mind. And they just don't understand Dharma, even though if they took an IQ test, they'd get 160 something, okay? Then you have other people who are totally uneducated, and you can look in the past, you know, all these stories of, you know, poor people or uneducated people, but they had really, you know, real wisdom in their minds, and they hear a little bit of Dharma and like, wow, you know, they get it, okay? So I highly recommend throwing out all your self-images of whether you're smart or dumb or what you know or what you don't know. Okay, because most of them are wrong, especially when it comes to the Dharma. Okay, now to kind of move into another topic here, I wanted to talk about the four misconceptions or the four distortions. And you know, it's quite interesting. Some people say, I'm a non-believer. Yeah, I don't have any religion. I don't believe in religion. I'm a non-believer. You know, my mind is just completely free from any kind of religious dogma. Well, you know, is that person really not believing in anything? Yeah. I mean, we say, I'm not a believer. But, I mean, there's a lot of basic beliefs in there, okay? And these four distortions, or these four wrong attention, wrong mental engagements, okay? These are beliefs that we have, ways we have of looking at the world that we often don't recognize that we have. And so even somebody who says, I'm a non-believer, believes in these things. Okay, so what are these four things that kind of permeate the whole take we have on the world? Well, first of all, we think that impermanent, changing, transient phenomena are static, fixed, and permanent. Okay? Forget philosophy. Yeah, I mean, we all say, oh, yes, everything's changing moment to moment. But why did my car get scratched? That wasn't supposed to happen. Yeah. Okay, so we have that, you know, these are also innate beliefs that we have. You know, we can get them reinforced, you know, by what we hear in wrong philosophies, but basic innate beliefs we come into this life with, you know, we react towards impermanent things as if they were fixed and permanent, don't we? You know, I mean, we look at our body. Do we feel like our body changed since yesterday? Do we feel like our body's getting older? Day by day, minute by minute? Do you really? You know, when you look in the mirror in the morning, do you really think your wrinkles are deeper the next day? Well, no, because you've been putting all that cream on, so they've got to look, you know, your wrinkles are less deep than that. That's how we think of impermanence, don't we? Our wrinkles are going to go away. We never think our wrinkles are going to get more. But in actual fact, that's what's happening, okay? Things are changing moment by moment, and yet we're trying to make them very fixed and solid. Yeah? So that's one misconception, one distorted view. A second one is that things that are suffering in nature are happy. And this is the big one that tricks us. I mean, we're very deceived by thinking impermanent things are permanent, but the one that thinks that unsatisfactory things are happy, this is the big one, okay? And this is the one that makes us like the rats that are always pecking to get their, you know, next hit. As we go along all day pecking, trying to get our pleasure. Okay, so it starts out with Starbucks in the morning, and it goes on from there, trying to get some kind of pleasure, thinking that all these things are going to make us happy. Okay, when we get praised, we feel that praise is real happiness. Okay, and we're seeking it, and we want it. When, you know, our plans go well, and we get acknowledged for the kind things we've done, and people, you know, congratulate us, we think this is happiness. Yeah, don't we? I mean, that's why we get so bent out of shape when we don't hear these pleasant words. Okay, if you think you don't have these attachments, just think of what happens in your mind when you don't get them. Then you'll see that you have them. Okay, you know, we love nice, pleasing words, and we don't get them, then we're upset. Okay, we think food is going to make us happy, so we try and get good food, and we try and have nice music, and we try and be around good people, and we're always looking outside for the latest thing that's going to make us feel good, and we feel if we got it that then we're successful and our lives are happy. Okay? In actual fact, do any of these things bring happiness? Well, you know, they bring a relief from certain kind of dissatisfaction or a relief from certain kind of suffering. But do they bring us a happiness that is some kind of durable happiness? No. You know, because eventually, you know, if they brought us happiness, then the more we had them, the more they would make us happy. And you say, well, I can never get enough happiness. You know, I mean, their praise. I mean, I can never get enough praise. But if somebody sat there like a tape recorder and just told you the same sweet words over and over again, you'd begin to feel like they were manipulating you, you know, and putting you on and using you. Okay, and we see that even we get all those nice words, we have a good reputation, we still don't feel good about ourselves. Okay, so, you know, we just have to look and see about the things in our life, you know, and how we think that things that, you know, are suffering in nature, how we really believe that they're going to bring us happiness, and how we found our whole life upon this belief. Okay? Just like we found our life upon the belief that impermanent things are permanent. Okay? You know, we think when we invest money, it's going to continue to grow. Okay? Then, the third distortion is thinking that impure things are pure. Okay, so again, here we take our body, for example. And, you know, we have all this propaganda, excuse me for the people who believe the propaganda, but, you know, it's propaganda, you know, the body is beautiful. I mean, we all heard this, didn't we? You know, because the alternative is your body is evil and sinful, and who wants that, okay? So we go to the other extreme of your body is beautiful. Actually, both of them are completely wrong, okay? But this whole thing of, oh, my body, so beautiful, you know, and so we go and sit in front of the mirror every day and, you know, check your hair and your makeup. I mean, the guys especially check their hair, you know, because it's all falling out. And, you know, check how do I look and how's my pot belly today? It's a little bit thinner and, you know, kind of we think that this body is pure and it's wonderful and it's, you know, so desirable. And then we think other people's bodies are the same way, so we want to hug and kiss their bodies. Okay? But if we really look what the body is, okay, does anything that come out of any orifice in your body look good to you? You know, before we eat the food, you have this wonderful lasagna. You know, it's great. As soon as it goes in, wherever it comes out, is it pure and clean after that? No way. Okay. So our body has this ability to make things kind of yucky, you know, according to our ordinary perception. This isn't inherently yucky, but, you know, the basic way we view our body is, you know, it's not pure and clean. Yeah? I mean, if you work for in ER, or you work with the 911, you know, and you see incredible things of people's bodies, you know, when they have bits of here and bits over there, and, you know, completely opened up from the inside. Do we think that's beautiful? Yeah? I mean, remember when you had the chance to take college anatomy? Did you take it, or did you find some way to get around it? Yeah, you took it, I know. I hope you took it. Otherwise, I'm not sure what you're doing. But, you know, we don't really look at the body, the insides of the body, and say, oh, this is great. And yet, our whole mind makes all this propaganda about the body is beautiful, you know. And so our body is beautiful and desirable. We want to hold on to our body. We don't want to separate from it at the time of death because it's so pure and so good. And other people's bodies are also pure and beautiful. We want to hug and kiss them, okay, until they die, and then we scream and run away. This shows just how wrong our whole mind is about what the body is, okay? So that's the third one, thinking impure things are pure. Fourth one is thinking that things, selfless things, have a self, okay? So things that, as they are in reality, do not have any kind of concrete essence, things that do not have any nature from their own side, we think have an essence, have a nature, exist under their own power independently. Huh? Okay, so this is the root one. This is the self-grasping ignorance. That's the root of samsara. Now, what's very interesting about these four, as we come to Dharma class and, you know, we write them down and we go, oh, yes, you know, I can see how these four are wrong. But we keep on living our life exactly as if they were true. You know, the moment we walk out of here, we're back into that same old perception. Okay? And that makes us incredibly blind to the value of the Dharma, because when we believe that in these four, we don't recognize that everything we perceive is wrong. Okay? And instead, we think that things exist in the way they appear to us. They appear to exist under their own power, and we believe that. They appear permanent and unchanging, and we believe that. They appear beautiful and giving us happiness. We believe it. They appear pure. We believe it. You know, we go along with this innately and structure our whole life around it, even though we can name these four and go blah, blah, blah about them. Okay? Now, what this does is that this means that it's a funny kind of thing, because it's like we're saying, well, I'm practicing the Dharma because my mind's full of misconceptions and I'm trying to realize reality. But our basic gut feeling is, I know what reality is. It's how I perceive things. Don't you think so? Isn't that your basic gut feeling? I know reality. I'm coming to Dharma, you know, kind of, okay, maybe it helps me get rid of my anger a little bit, but I know reality. Yeah? We don't go around all day, and every time we see something saying, this is wrong, we go around all day saying, this is right. It exists the way it appears to me. But all we have to do is use a little bit of logic, you know, look a little bit deeper. We'll see that every single perception we have is wrong. I mean, completely whacked out, bananas, wrong. Okay, and, you know, but this doesn't go along with our self-image, because we're intelligent, we're bright, we're always right, aren't we? We're not wrong. We're right. But, you know, this is what undermines our drive to practice the Dharma, is that we don't realize how wrong we are. And sometimes you might be doing retreat or, you know, meditating, and all of a sudden, something goes boing, and you go, my God, my mind is totally off this planet. You know, forget about, you know, the distortions that come when we have anger and jealousy, which are, you know, really compounding things. But just the kind of normal, relaxed state of my mind totally has nothing to do with what reality is. Yeah, this is not something we're used to thinking about. Yeah, but it's really the way things are. I mean, you just take our sense perceptions. Take what you're seeing with your eyes right now. You know, we look out there, we see people, don't we? Okay, there's Julie and Kim and Linda and Barbara and Beth, Bonnie and everybody else, okay? Yeah, they are, in our view, they are real people out there, aren't they? There's real people out there. That's wrong. Yeah. Because all there are bodies and minds, and we impute a person on top of that. Well, we don't know that we did that. We think there's real people out there. And more important, there's a real person in here. Okay? And just even, we look with our eyes again. Everything looks quite fixed and solid, doesn't it? You know? It's all kind of static, predictable, secure. Yeah. But in actual fact, even from a scientific view, you know, all the little subatomic particles are whirling around at this incredible rate and changing all the time, so that, you know, our body, the table, the microphone, everything we're looking at is not remaining the same moment to moment. And yet, we feel, we live, as if this world is completely static and predictable. It's not. You know? And we look around us and we say, oh, all these nice people and this nice place, and I'm so comfortable. Just pretend you are. yeah, nice soft meditation cushions. I'm so glad DSF finally got them. And this is happiness. I have my car and my family, and I just had dinner, and this is good. This is happiness. And we believe it, don't we? And it's wrong. Okay, and you know, as we feel about our body, oh, you know, I'm going to take care of this body and I want to keep it forever because it's so wonderful. Yeah, and yet it's this sack of junk, basically. Yeah, so you see, just, you know, kind of our raw, basic experience. I'm not talking philosophy, this is just raw stuff. Okay. Forget realizing ultimate reality, you know, the emptiness of inherent existence. We don't even understand conventionally how wrong our perceptions are. You know, how our conventional perceptions are wrong. Okay? So we perceive neither ultimate truths nor conventional truths accurately. Okay. Now, all existent phenomena are either ultimate truths or conventional truths. So if we don't perceive either of those two accurately, we don't perceive anything accurately. Okay. So this means we're in trouble. Hmm? Because when you misperceive things, you get into trouble. You goof. Yeah, and so that's why we're making big boo-boos all day long, because of these four misconceptions. You know, we're operating in a fantasy land created by our own wrong conception mind, and then we wonder why we have problems. Okay, and it's just the wrong conception mind. Huh? Okay, so how does the Manjushri practice help do something about these four? Yeah. And I especially like this teaching on the four misconceptions, you know. I don't get it really often. I mean, you get it from time to time, but in actual fact, it's one of my favorites because it really cuts to the quick. And, it, you know, I mean, it's just no messing around with this one, okay? But how does the tantric practice, how does the practice of Manjushri help us resolve these four? Okay, well, first of all, and by the way, these are just some of my ideas playing with this. As you meditate, you're going to understand more and deeper from your own side about how the tantric practice, you know, acts as an antidote to these four distortions. So I'm not giving you the answers here. I'm just giving you some things to contemplate, and then you're going to find through your own meditation and your own experience more stuff. Okay? But the first one, seeing impermanent things as permanent. Well, when you're doing the sadhana, okay, your whole body disappears. Okay? You have impermanence there. Okay? You arise. You know, there's the egg and the D, and then that changes, doesn't it, into Manjushri. And then there's more change because Manjushri's radiating out this light. And there's more change because then all the wisdom beings are dissolving into you. And there's more change because you're radiating out offering goddesses that are making offerings, and you're experiencing pleasure, and they're dissolving into you. And when you're doing the mantra recitation, there's light radiating out there and invoking, you know, Manjushris and invoking wheels and texts and swords and Oma Homs and mantra garlands, and everything's moving and changing all the time in the sadhana, right? So that's teaching us something about change, isn't it? Yeah, that even when you're meditating on yourself as Manjushri, you are not some fixed, unchangeable thing. Yeah, you Manjushri is constantly changing. Yeah, everything, but everything's emanating everywhere and absorbing, and there's all this stuff happening. Okay? So it's really interesting when you do the sadhana, you know, sometimes pay a special attention to how things are changing and be really aware of impermanence as you meditate on the sadhana. Yeah, make that kind of the focal thing as you're meditating. You know, this session I'm going to really focus on on impermanence in how I'm doing this visualization. Okay? Especially at the end, you're radiating out the light. Everything dissolves, doesn't it? Yeah? Whole environmental sentient beings, everything dissolves. Goodbye. Yeah? Impermanent. Okay? Now, the one about how we think that things that by their nature are unsatisfactory are happiness, how does the practice go against those? Well, first of all, when we gain an idea of its unsatisfactory nature, then it helps us to offer it because we see there's nothing to cling on to. Okay? And what's quite interesting here in the Manjushri Sadhana is that we're not offering ordinary things. It's not like, I see this candy is really in the nature of suffering, so Manjushri, you can have it now. You know, I see it's really garbage, it's not going to bring me any happiness, so it's okay, I can offer it to Manjushri. It's not like that, okay? We dissolve the candy into emptiness, it appears as a pure substance, and we offer that. Okay? So we're helping to diminish this idea of things that are unsatisfactory being satisfactory by dissolving them into emptiness and then by offering them. Okay? Similarly, when we see, so there I'm talking about how we go from ordinary vision to the clear appearance. Okay? Another way is, like with people, we always, when we look at ordinary people, we think they're going to bring us real happiness. When we realize that the people are in the nature of being unsatisfactory, and then we stop thinking that other people are going to make us happy. But just think for a minute how different your life would be if you stopped thinking that other people would make you happy. Isn't this kind of a basic preconception in your mind that other people are going to make you happy? You know, if I'm only with this person, if I spend time with that person, if this one likes me, then I'll be happy. We expect other people to make us happy. They can't. Why? Because they're changing. Because they're in the nature of suffering. Okay? Once we realize this and we stop expecting them to make us happy, then that enables us to drop a lot of our projections on them. And we begin to be able to see their Buddha nature. And we begin to be able to see how they could potentially become deities. Because when we have the old view that, you know, thinks this person who, you know, who's whose nature is suffering is actually happy when we see it in the old way, then there's no space in our mind to see that person in any other way, because we think that person is really like that, and we expect them to be able to bring us happiness, and we count on them to bring us happiness. Okay? And we can't see them in any other way except as another living being who's going to make us happy. Don't you think, when you think about the people who are important in your life, you know, am I popping a few little bubbles here? But, you know, I mean, it's true, isn't it? We think they're going to make me happy. And when we have that image projected on them, we project so much stuff. Because there's all this expectation that this living being, they're going to live forever, they're always going to be there, they're going to make me happy. When I'm with them, I'm going to be joyful. We have so much stuff and preconceptions that we project on the people that we quote-unquote love, that there's no space for them to move. Okay? When we realize that that's a wrong conception and we let go of that, okay, we stop expecting them to make us happy, then when we look at them, we see something completely different. Okay? And especially as we stop grasping at them as being inherently existent, there's a body, there's a mind, there's a person that exists by being merely labeled. There's more fluidity in there. And we begin to say, well, who is this person? And we realize there's no essence in the person. Okay? And that lack of essence is their fundamental Buddha nature. It's their emptiness of inherent existence. And that emptiness is what gives them the possibility to change and become Buddhists. It's because they aren't inherently anything that they can change and become Buddhists. If they were inherently our child or lover or friend or whoever it is, they could never change and become a Buddha because they are inherently this, you know? But when we leave aside our expectations on them, then we can begin to see their emptiness. And when we see their emptiness, we see their potential to become a Buddha. And so when we're doing the Manjushri practice, and especially in the sessions and in the break times, we're trying with our mental consciousness to see all sentient beings as Buddhas, this is what it's doing. Okay? It's counteracting the mind that sees them, you know, as bringing us samsaric happiness. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? Okay? So, when we practice in the Manjushri practice, seeing all these sentient beings as Buddhas, we have let go of that ordinary view that thinks that they are capable of giving us happiness. Okay? And we've let go of all that expectation, and that gives us the ability to see that they have the Buddha nature. And seeing that they have the Buddha nature, that they aren't inherently this, that, or the other thing, gives us a way to relate to them in a pure way. Okay? Because if there's somebody and we think that they are inherently good and pleasurable, then when they make a mistake, they become inherently obnoxious, and we get inherently angry at them. And then we're always fighting with all these things that our mind has created. When we realize that there's nothing there inherently, then there's this space for playing. Okay? Yeah. We see somebody's basic nature, their basic potential, as something pure. Huh? Okay. How does practicing Manjushri help us get rid of thinking that impure things are pure? Well, at the beginning of the practice, this body, flesh and bones body, you know, this basic thing that is, you know, just kind of yucky, dissolves into emptiness. Okay. Now, we think dissolve into emptiness means it just completely vanishes and doesn't exist anymore. That's not the case. It's not like, you know, poof, my body's gone. But what we're realizing is that there's no inherently existent body there. There's no inherently ordinary body there. There's no inherently impure body there. You know, but what we call body is something that's merely labeled on all this collection of different parts, you know, of all these whirling atoms and molecules that is appearing in a certain way that we label body, you know, in dependence on that appearance, and then it appears, you know, as a body to us. Okay? But when we meditate on emptiness, then that ordinary appearance disappears. We see that it's empty. And instead what happens is when you do the self-generation, there you are with a body of light. Okay? So this body that we clung on to before, you know, thinking that the impure thing is pure, we completely dissolved into emptiness. And instead there's this body of light. And in dependence upon the body of light, and the wisdom that realizes emptiness, and whatever bodhicitta we have, because we're generating all these thoughts and attitudes and emotions in the practice, independence on those, all those mind states, and independence on the body of light, then we label Manjushri. We label I. Okay? And that's what the self-generation is all about. Okay? So we're no longer identifying ourselves as having this kind of contaminated body, and we're no longer relating to our body as some kind of contaminated thing that gets old and sick and dies, and, you know, whose knees hurt, and, you know, who's getting too many wrinkles and gray hairs and fat and, you know, slouchy and everything else. But instead we're a 16-year-old Manjushri. And that's good, isn't it? Going back in the time machine, you know. I'm 16 years old, you know. Manjushri with my sword. Okay. But it's a whole different way of relating to your body. Okay, so it's very good when you're doing the self-generation, really focus sometimes on what does it feel like to have a body made of light that looks like Manjushri. Yeah, so instead of, you know, here's little old me with my stomach ache and, you know, and I don't look the way I wish I looked, that body's gone. You've dissolved it into emptiness. It's no longer appearing to your mind. What is appearing to your mind is that body made of light that you're labeling, you know, and dependent on that, you're labeling I. Okay? You're labeling Manjushri. So that's completely getting rid of that concept of, you know, impure things being pure. Hmm? Okay, so it's very important when you're doing the Manjushri practice, it isn't that our ordinary body becomes Manjushri. Yeah, don't think that, you know, okay, there's the egg and, you know, the light radiates out and then my ordinary body becomes Manjushri. No, our ordinary body ceases to appear because we realize it's empty of inherent existence. Okay, the body that we label Manjushri is, you know, something arisen out of that wisdom that realizes the emptiness of our ordinary self and our ordinary body. Okay, it's that wisdom appearing as Manjushri, and that is, you know, what we associate with I. works. It's a whole different way of thinking of our body.
Okay, because it's not a body made of atoms and molecules. It's a body whose nature is wisdom. So that's why it's very helpful when you're doing the sadhana, when you pause, you know, like before you say the mantra and you meditate on yourself as Manjushri. You just sit there and really feel like what it feels like to have this body made alive. And that can actually be a challenge, you know, because as time has gone on and doing this practice myself, I begin to see, you know, at the beginning when I was doing it, my body of light was very solid.
Yeah,
it was kind of like, a regular old body, but somehow with a light bulb inside. You know, my internal feeling was a regular body with a light bulb. And then it kind of, you know, went on from there to become like this thing, like an outer sheath made of concrete that was empty inside and filled with light.
Okay?
But, you know, when you really focus on having a body made of light, that means that there's the boundary from in here and out there is not so clear and distinct. You know, there's no kind of line around where my body of light stops. Okay? And it just gives you a whole different feeling. And especially your internal organs, it's like, you know, we usually feel like this is inside. But there's just light inside there, you know. And that's it, folks.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, our old body, we feel like, you know, something hits it and can't go through. But you have this body of light, and, you know, everything's going in and, you know, radiating in and radiating out of it all the time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're meditating and you're invoking all those Manjushris, and some are as big as mountains and some are as big as you know, tips, dewdrops, and they're all falling into you and they all fit.
Yeah.
Where do you fit the big Manjushri that's like a mountain? Okay? So it gives you a whole different feeling about your body. So it, you know, it works in that way to counteract this feeling of our body being something solid, being something impure.
Yeah, or being something pure.
You know, because even if it is pure. And then last of all, you know, there's this fourth distortion, thinking that things that don't have a self. Okay? And here, self means inherent existence. The word self means different things in different contexts. When we talk about the self-grasping of persons, or when we talk about the selflessness of persons, the selflessness of phenomena, the word self in those situations, it doesn't mean self as in person, it means inherent existence. Okay? So this fourth distortion of thinking that things that are selfless have a self, okay? It means thinking that things that don't have inherent existence, that don't exist under their own power, from their own side, with their own essence as findable entities, thinking that things that don't exist that way do, that they actually have that kind of nature and essence and findability.
Okay?
And so, this realization of emptiness, of the selflessness, this is actually the thing that you can see is the essence of the whole practice and the essential thing that helps you counteract the other three distortions. You know, this understanding of selflessness counteracts all four distortions, actually. Can you see that, how that works in the sadhana? Okay?
Yeah,
because you've dissolved yourself into into emptiness, reappeared as Manjushri on the basis of being empty, then you are no longer seeing your impure body as pure. On the basis of the offerings and objects here in your Manjushri environment, you no longer see those things as, you know, you no longer mistake those things which are in the nature of suffering as having the nature of happiness, because you've dissolved them into emptiness and they've arisen in a pure form. So that whole way of conceiving about them has stopped. Yeah. The things that we used to see as permanent,
that are actually in fact impermanent, when we dissolve them into emptiness and they reappear as pure things, either the environment or ourselves or the other sentient beings, by that virtue of having dissolved them into emptiness, when they reappear, we understand that they're transient, you know, that they're changing moment by moment by moment. Because something that is empty has to, you know, if it exists on the, if it's an appearance, if it's a positive phenomenon, it's also going to be impermanent and changing. Okay? So this understanding of selflessness is what undercuts all four of the distortions. And so that's why this whole practice is basically a meditation on emptiness, on selflessness. And that's why at the very beginning of the practice, we do the meditation on emptiness. You know, and we're doing Om Sarva Vasudeva to Sarvadhamma Sarva Vasudeva Hum, because it's all empty. Okay? And then on that basis, you arise and you generate things that appear in exactly the opposite way as the way they appear to the four distortions. Okay? So you see how skillful this is? You know? How profound this way of meditating is? Yeah? I mean, it's really quite something. So the more that you can understand the philosophy behind Tantra, and the more that you can recognize the four distortions in your own mind, and the more you can see how those four are wrong, because the more you can recognize them, the more you can see they're wrong. Okay? Then, the more you can do all of that, then the more effective your Manjushri meditation is going to be. Yeah. Whereas if you don't have this background and understand the four distortions, if you can't recognize them in your own mind, if you can't see them as wrong, then you might do this whole practice and have this great image of here I am, Manjushri, and you feel so blissful, but nothing changes in your mind because you're seeing yourself as an inherently existing Manjushri. And you're offering inherently existent things to this inherently existing Manjushri. And what you're doing when you see other sentient beings as Manjushri is you're imputing on them an inherently existent purity. Okay? And so then your practice never seems to go right. And that's why people get so tangled up sometimes in understanding Tantra. Because we hear, you know, for example, in Tantra, well, you see all beings as Buddhas. So we think, oh, all beings are Buddhas. And our mind thinks, therefore, they are inherently existent Buddhas. If somebody is an inherently existent Buddha, everything they do is right. So that means, you know, dropping bombs on this country is right, because that's the Buddha dropping bombs. Okay? And this person telling that one off, and this person mistreating that one, well, they're all Buddhas, so everything they do is right. Okay? Do you see? And this gets into this whole thing about, well, the guru is Buddha, so, you know, your guru is doing something that you have no idea of what you're what they're doing. And you're thinking, well, they're an inherently existent Buddha. So what they're doing is inherently existently right. Now, and then all this stuff happens, okay? So that happens because we aren't understanding the basic fundamental thing about Tantra, which is emptiness. And that the whole practice of Tantra is based on emptiness. Okay? And so instead, we're projecting all this inherently existent purity. Okay? But we're not getting rid of our four distortions. Okay? And what we're basically doing is plastering over our vision of heaven onto our contaminated vision. Okay? So it's garbage and we're putting frosting on top of it. And we're thinking now it's good. But it's the same old stuff. And so that's why, you know, this understanding of emptiness is so essential for practicing Tantra. And we often don't get this at the beginning, or at least I didn't, you know, because you come into these practices and it's so nice. Here I am and I'm Manjushri now. This is good, you know. And we're not really getting what it means to meditate on emptiness. Okay? Or if we start to meditate on emptiness, then we go to the extreme of nihilism and we think nothing exists. Oh, it's all dissolved in emptiness. I don't exist anymore, you know? You take my ego away and I don't exist. Okay? Lama Yeshe had this very nice, sweet example to counteract that fear, because sometimes we have that fear, don't we? You know? But I know who I am and I'm the solemn here. I'm the solemn. I'm real. And if emptiness means I'm not real, then there's nothing there. And I freak out. So Lama gave this really sweet example. Like when we have a big ego, okay, we buy a big car. Yeah, and our car represents our ego. Because, you know, I mean, people do, don't they? You know, you buy a really nice car because this represents your ego. There it is out on the highway for everybody to see. My car is special. You know, and he was saying, your car can disappear, but you can still be there. So your ego can disappear, but the conventional self still exists. Okay? So he was saying that to assuage our fear that if we realize emptiness, we're going to feel like, you know, there's nothing there whatsoever. Yeah? Because we're just letting go of all the wrong conceptions. There's still a conventional self, but you can't find that conventional self when you analyze, because it's only an appearance, and it exists only by being labeled independence on a base. You know, there's nothing else there. But that's the extent of conventional existence, okay? So there's still a self there, and that's why out of emptiness, Manjushri can appear and the offerings and the whole environment can appear. But those are only things that exist on the level of appearances, that exist by the power of being merely labeled, you know? Aside from that, they don't have any essence in them. They're empty. So the whole practice is this interplay between dependent arising and emptiness. And it's not just dependent arising and emptiness on an ordinary level, you know, that the bell is dependently arising and it's empty, and, you know, me is dependently arising and empty. But we're also getting rid of the ordinary view and the ordinary grasping that sees everything as somehow ordinary. Okay? So instead of, you know, well, yeah, the bell's empty and it's dependent arising, when you dissolve it into emptiness, it appears as something in a pure land. You know, it appears as the nature of blissful wisdom. So that dependent arising, do you see how the meditation on emptiness and dependent arising in Tantra, there's a slightly different flavor than in Sutra? Because you're making it arise as a pure article after you've dissolved it into emptiness. In the Sutra practice, you know, you meditate on things as empty, and then you see that they, you know, exist dependently due to causes and conditions, and that's it. But there's not this thing of transforming them into a pure substance because there's something empty. And so it's the same way with our self-image. In Sutra, okay, there's no inherently existent me, but there's a conventional me. But in Tantra, there's no inherently existent me, and there's a conventional me that is Manjushri. Okay. So it's a totally different new feeling about yourself and your own potential. Yeah, the conventional self, the conventional I, is labeled independence on pure aggregates, not aggregates that are results of karma and delusion. Okay? It's what the I is now labeled on pure aggregates that are arising out of wisdom, you know? And the body aggregate is made of light, and the mental aggregates are bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness and all the other good qualities. Okay? So what you're labeling I and dependence on in Tantra is a different base than what you're labeling I on and independence on in Sutra. So it brings a whole different feeling to it because you begin to get some sense of how it's possible to become a Buddha and what a Buddha is and what a Buddha actually does. And so it's kind of like, when you're meditating on yourself as Manjushri, it's a dress rehearsal for you becoming a Buddha. Okay? because you're dissolving all the ordinary. You're not only dissolving the inherently existent appearance and therefore letting go of the grasping at inherent existence, but you're dissolving the appearance of everything as ordinary and you're grasping at it as ordinary. So therefore it can arise as something pure, and that's where you get into a Buddha creating a pure land. And when you're a Buddha and you create a pure land, then you can help so many sentient beings in that pure land. Okay? So there's a whole different flavor to it. Yeah, completely different flavor. Okay? So, maybe some questions? Comments? Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm going to ask this question. What I'm changing is my perception of my conventional self from this impure reflection that I've labeled best to this pure reflection to label consciousness. Where?
Okay.
What was the answer?
Because you can't have two conceptions at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Just a regular thing.
It never was there to start with, is the point. Yeah, it wasn't that the old Betts walked out the door. Yeah, the old Betts was a fantasy to start with. Hmm. Okay, it's like realizing that the water on the asphalt, I mean, that the water on the asphalt is a mirage. And that the face, you know, that you're seeing in the mirror is not a real face. It wasn't like the water evaporated. There wasn't any water on the asphalt to start with. And it wasn't like the face left the mirror. There wasn't a face there to start with. Okay?
And the basis upon which we're putting everything is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's my mind. The
wisdom that realizes the emptiness of your own mind is appearing as this body of light. Independence on that, you label Manjushri. Your blissful wisdom that realizes the emptiness of all phenomena, okay, that wisdom appears in the form of Manjushri. And independence on that, you label Manjushri, or you label I. Okay?
I can understand the idea that, I've labeled my conventional self on the basis of my body and mind, and that I can realize, okay, you know, that's incorrect perception, and so I can, so it's not really there the way I think it exists. And then I can decide, okay, if I can label myself any way I want to be Manjushri, and I'll relabel this conventional self Manjushri that's not inherently existent. But I don't understand labeling the wisdom realizing the emptiness as well.
Well, see, what you're saying is, you know, you can see that there's no person inside the aggregate, so then I'll label it Manjushri. That's this thing of feeling like your ordinary body's becoming Manjushri's body. You haven't really gotten rid of the idea of your ordinary body. You haven't really let go of the inherent existence of your own body or of your own mind. Okay? So it's not like, you know, there's a real solid body and there's a real solid mind, and I'm just taking the label Peter off of it and putting the label Manjushri on top of it. But actually, it's the same body and same mind. And I'm going to think that because I called it Manjushri that all of a sudden it's a Buddha. Uh-uh. Okay? In other words, you know, the Peter body is a hallucination to start with. The Peter mind is a hallucination to start with. Yeah. So not only is Peter, you know, there's no solid Peter there. There's no solid Peter's body or Peter's mind. The whole thing is... Okay? And then that wisdom that realizes that appears, and on top, you know, in the dependence on that, it's labeled Manjushri.
So I label that wisdom Manjushri.
The appearance of that wisdom in the form of Manjushri, those new aggregates that you've assumed, is independence on that. You label Manjushri. Okay? So it's not independence on, you know, the same old body and the same old mind you had before. Okay? Yeah?
just getting caught on the
independence of. This is actually a very important phrase, you know, because you'll hear me, I keep saying that, you know. It's not that you label, you know, on the basis, on the body and mind, you label. Okay, independence on the body and mind. There's a slight kind of flavor difference there, because we kind of say on the body and mind, we feel like there's a real body and a real mind, and we just kind of stick the label on it. It's more, you know, and like once the label's stuck on it, you know, once you have that label that it's a real thing because, you know, it's now wrapped in plastic and on the shelf, but it's independence on the body and mind, showing that the object that's labeled, okay, is not the body and it's not the mind. It's something that's labeled independence on that, but it's not either of those. And it's not something that's put on top of it, you know, like saran wrap. Okay? It's not like you label Manjushri, so therefore that body and mind now become a unit. Okay?
My confusion is about in depending on as two words and one word.
It's in dependence on. Okay, it's three words. It's not independence.
That's
it's in dependence
right.
on. Okay? Yeah.
Could you say that our the mind as it is right now, the ordinary mind, uh-huh. I guess which it has, that mind is appearing as this type of body, this flesh and blood body, and wisdom realizing emptiness is also a mind. And it appears as
the Can we say that our ordinary body is an appearance of our ordinary mind? Not in the same way that Manjushri's body is an appearance of Manjushri's mind. Because our ordinary mind, our ordinary body is material in nature. And it and our mind have different continuums. Because we die and, you know, body has its continuum and the worms eat it. Okay?
But the wisdom
really
is a mind.
Yeah. But you see, when you get into the subtle thing with Tantra, especially highest class Tantra, is the extremely subtle mind and the extremely subtle wind are one nature, one entity. So if you have the extremely subtle mind being wisdom, it is one entity with the extremely subtle wind. So that can appear essence, and that's how you get the Dharmakaya and the Sambhogakaya at the same time being unified, okay? Yeah? You want something really mind boggling to think about that one, okay? Yeah?
Well, it almost seems like we're doomed to do the practice wrong until we really know.
The ultimate pessimist, we're doomed to do the practice wrong until we get it right.
Until we get it right. I mean, it's like you know, really have to do some realized emptiness, and you're not going to quite have it right.
Yeah, but, you know, this is the method with which you develop the wisdom realizing emptiness, okay? It's like, you know, in the process of becoming a doctor, you had to be able to imagine yourself as a doctor, you know? So when you were 3 years old, you put on, you know, a white coat, yeah, and you had your little plastic stethoscope. And by slowly, you know, and even when you started medical school, you know, you don't know what in the world you're doing, but you weren't your clothes and you kind of get the idea, okay, I'm a doctor. And, you know, you kind of keep playing and playing. And then eventually, you know, you just keep playing, don't you? Except now you have a diploma on the wall saying that you play okay. Yeah? So, it's the, you know, by the process of pretending that you're something, you become that. So that's why they say, always be careful what you pretend to be, because you might become what you're pretending to be, you know, if you do it wrong. Is that something?
Well, I get mixed up in hearing it. I think I heard you say the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Wait,
I guess in the realization of this, the mind is the thing that's transformed into the Manjushri body. So that to me sounds like some aspect of awareness of the section of consciousness.
Yep, and this is where we're getting into, you know, that because our ordinary body and our ordinary mind have two totally different natures. Ordinary body is material, it's made of atoms and molecules, it has color and shape. Ordinary mind, totally immaterial. Okay, when you get into this thing about the extremely subtle mind and extremely subtle body being the same nature, okay, they're one entity, but it's called different isolates, which is this whole philosophical thing. But anyway, you know, when you get into that, then the division between body and mind, as we know it, blurs. Okay, and I think this has to do a little bit with how we grasp at things as inherently existent too.
So, but
like,
is to realize
the
emptiness
of
the mind. It's
an
idealistic
mind
that we don't realize.
Yeah, so we don't really realize emptiness, you know, but we're pretending we've realized it.
So it's referring to that extremely subtle mind?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why we try and meditate on emptiness at the beginning, to get some flavor of what it is. Okay, we may not have the real realization, but you have some flavor.
I'm not sure how to ask, but when you're answering this question, you're pretending to be something you are, I think, just in terms of pragmatics, part of my confusion about conventional reality and how to function in the world, pretending to be something I'm not, or I'm pretending to be something I am.
Pretending to be something you aren't versus pretending to be something. Do you think you're Lori? Do you think what you're pretending to be when you go to work every day is who you are? Do you think that what you are pretending to be when you're with your family is who you really are?
Not always, no.
Sometimes, do you think it is?
Of course.
You know, well, I mean, this is what was so great about Lama Yeshe. You know, he used to look at us and he said, "You don't need to take drugs, dear. You're hallucinating all the time." You know? And this is the whole point. We are. You know, all day long, our notion of who we are is wrong. Okay, we're coming back to the four distortions again, and how we don't recognize them as wrong and we think they're right. You know, our whole idea of who we are is wrong. Yeah? So that's why I always tell people in Buddhism, we're not trying to find out who we are, we're trying to find out who we aren't. Because our whole problem is we think we are a bunch of things that we aren't. You know, because we think we're permanent and we're partless and we're independent and we're pure, we have the nature of happiness and we have a self, but, you know, I'm totally incapable and unlovable, but I have all these good qualities that other people don't appreciate, but really I'm a mess inside and confused. If other people only recognize that, nobody would love me. You know, the whole thing is wrong. Yeah. In big caps, not small caps. Wrong. Okay? And yet we believe it all. Okay? So we have to check up and see if who we think we are is real.
And
if it isn't, then
we have to,
let me
go see a therapist.
We've got to keep the therapist in business. So, you know, if you don't know who you are, go see her, okay? I mean, that's the thing. In therapy, you're working with the conventional self, but you're not looking at the real nature of the self. You know, underlying therapy is the notion that there's a real person there.
But I think it's confused about what is the conventional self.
Well, you know, it's hard to understand the conventional self until you've understood emptiness.
Yes. And that's what I said, like, we don't perceive ultimate truths or conventional truths correctly. So the more we can get an idea of emptiness and how there's nothing in there that's there from its own side, then the more we can get an idea of, oh, but, you know, things exist by being merely labeled in dependence upon all that stuff. Yeah? So the more you understand emptiness, the more you're going to understand conventional truths as being conventional truths. Okay. Let's quietly meditate now.
Many lifetimes of work.